Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Ralph Compton's Trail of the Gunfighter series. Narrated by Terrence Aselford, with performances by Danny Gavigan, Tracy Oliveira, David Coyne, Eric Messner, Dylan Lynch, Joel David Santner, Drew Kopas, Ken Jackson, Tim Carlin, Richard Rowan, Jeff Allen, Casey Platt, Bradley Smith, Kimberly Gilbert, Michael Glenn, James Konacek, Alyssa Wilmoth, Christopher Graybill, Scott McCormick, Christopher Sheeran, Lily Beacon, Nick DePinto, Elizabeth Jernigan, Gary Tells, Tony Nam, Joe Brack, Michael John Casey, Thomas Keegan, Joseph Thornhill, James Lewis, Nanette Savard, Barbara Pinnellini, Bobby Aselford, Daniel Sontag, and Mort Shelby. Trail of the Gunfighter Number 3, Autumn of the Gun, Part 1. Southern Arizona Territory, April 18th, 1877. Nathan Stone plunged headlong back into the thicket from which he had just emerged, the shackles on his wrists impeding his progress. He wondered where his dog Empty was. While the hound had aided in his escape from Tavesby and Doss, the men delivering Nathan to Yuma Territorial Prison, Nathan was now on his own. He was afoot, wounded, his wrists manacled, half-starved, and without a weapon. He crept deeper into the thicket. Nearing the end of his second day as a fugitive, having had no food since the morning of his escape, there was weakness in his body and dizziness in his head.
He's in there, by God, and he ain't armed. We got him now.
Nathan lay still, overcome by weakness. Sundown was 2 hours away, but even if he evaded them until then, what good would it do him? By morning, weak from hunger and loss of blood, he would be at their mercy. As he lay there, his mind drifted back to that dark day in Pueblo, Colorado, where his friend Harley Stafford lay near death. Nathan had become involved with Harley's sister, Vivian, and his ensuing friendship with Harley had secured Harley a position with the railroad. But Harley'd been gunned down by outlaws during a train robbery, and again Nathan Stone had taken to the Vengeance Trail. Leaving Vivian with her critically wounded brother, Nathan had taken the trail of the outlaws, tracking them to Southern Arizona Territory. Reaching a town, Nathan had discovered too late that it was inhabited entirely by outlaws, including the judge and the sheriff. This time, even Nathan's fast draw couldn't save him. He had been forced into a gunfight, charged with murder, and sentenced to hard labor. In chains, he had fought with and killed a brutal guard, and his punishment was more terrible than anything he could have imagined. To his horror, he was being sent to the territorial prison at Yuma as part of a profitable scheme devised by crooked officials at the prison and the outlaw Judge Ponder. For $10,000, an inmate at Yuma would be allowed to escape. The prison would report the escapee had been captured, but the man actually being returned to Yuma would be Nathan Stone. Judge Ponder had selected Doss and Tavesby to deliver Nathan to Yuma Territorial Prison, and on April 15, 1877, the trio had ridden west. One morning beside the Gila River, when they had been about to resume their journey, Nathan had made his move. Empty, the hound, had attacked one of his captors while Nathan had gone after the other. His hands still manacled, Nathan had escaped by leaping into the river. Fearing the wrath of Judge Ponder, Tavesby and Doss had not given up the chase, and now they were closing in. Nathan was about to struggle to his feet, but to his relief he saw only his faithful hound. Tavesby and Doss had dismounted. Counting on Nathan being wounded, weak, and manacled, they were pursuing him into the thicket. The instant one of the searchers appeared, the hound was on him in a fury. When Doss dropped the colt, Nathan seized it. Tavesby was right behind Doss. He raised his gun, but it was too late.
Old son, if it wasn't for you, that might have turned out a lot differently.
Empty sat there watching him as Nathan searched both the dead men. He found the key to the manacles and freed his hands.
Come on, first thing we do is find the horses the varmints was riding and fix us some grub.
Nathan took the colts and gun rigs from both the dead men, and when he found their saddled horses, there was a Winchester in each saddle boot. He went through the saddlebags, finding bacon, coffee beans, hardtack, and most of a bottle of whiskey. With trembling hands, he started a fire, filled the blackened coffee pot at the river, and hacked off chunks of bacon. Sharing the bacon with Empty, he ate it half raw, drinking the coffee right from the pot. Nathan, mounted on one of the horses and leading the other, rode up river until he found his own horse, where his pursuers had picketed it.
Yeah.
He picketed the other two horses alongside it.
We'll rest a day or two, Empty. Then we have some unfinished business with Judge Ponder, Sheriff Hondo, and the rest of those coyotes in that outlaw town.
Two days later, Nathan set the outlaws' horses free and headed north. Empty was somewhere ahead of him, and when Nathan was within a mile or two of Ponder's town, he circled it. To the south, he found what he was seeking. There were the fresh tracks of many horses, and the trail led west. Nathan reined up, and Empty came trotting out of the brush.
Looks like the judge mounted everybody that could ride. Empty, it's time we called on Judge Ponder and showed that old coyote the error of his ways.
Nathan picketed his horse in a thicket and made his way on foot toward Ponder's quarters, which also served as a jail. Coming in behind the building, he paused. He pointed toward the dirt street, and Empty bounded ahead. Nathan knew the dog would return to warn him of danger. The dog trotted the length of the street, then came back quietly, and Nathan stepped around the corner of the jail. Two horses were tied at the hitch rail before the building. Nathan stepped up on the porch from one end. He eased up beside the door.
Damn it, Roscoe. If they don't ride him down, we're finished.
The voice belonged to Judge Ponder.
They won't ride him down because he won't be there. Them horses coming in with empty saddles is proof enough he's cashed in Tasby and Doss. Now he's got a horse and a gun and he's on his way here.
Yeah, well, I fear you may be right. I want you to remain here in this office until Sheriff Hondo and the posse return.
Right you are. I can take him. That's why I didn't ride with the posse. I'll gamble there ain't a man in the territory faster with a colt than me.
You lose.
Nathan circled around and headed for the site where the dam was being built by a chain gang. Normally, there were two guards, and if one of them had gone to investigate the shooting at the jail, Nathan would be facing only one of them at a time. When he neared the dam, he could see the men had ceased work, and Sanchez, the remaining guard, was awaiting word as to what the shooting had been about. Within pistol range, Nathan stepped out of the brush.
Sanchez!
Sanchez had a Winchester in the crook of his left arm, but he went for his Colt.
Stone! God bless you. Get us out of these chains so we can help you.
Some of you search Sanchez. See if he has the key to your irons and free yourselves. That other guard will be coming back on the run. I aim to welcome him.
Oh, damn it. He ain't got the key to these irons. Gustavus must have it.
He'll be coming back, and I'm sure he won't object to us having it.
He sure as hell won't.
Where's the other work gang?
Work in the fields? What's happening in town?
I talked some sense to Judge Ponder and one of his gun throwers in a language they could understand. Once we've rid ourselves of these guards, we're going to prepare a reception for Sheriff Hondo and his posse that's out looking for me.
Two men galloped toward Nathan. The prisoner who had Sanchez's Winchester shot one of them out of the saddle. The second man wheeled his horse and tried to run, but Nathan was too fast. Quickly, the men searched Gustavus and came up with keys to their leg irons.
While you're freeing yourselves, I'm going after that other guard. If there are more of these coyotes around, you now have weapons. Use them. I'll be back.
Nathan took a horse belonging to one of the dead guards and rode toward the distant fields. He must get within gun range before the remaining guard recognized him. But his luck didn't hold. It became a dangerous situation, for the guard was kneeling, firing a Winchester. But some of the prisoners came to Nathan's aid. They piled on the guard from behind and seized his Winchester and his Colt, and he was dead before Nathan reached him. Quickly, the men went through the dead guard's pockets, found the key to their leg irons, and freed themselves.
Come on. Sheriff Hondo's out with a posse, and we have to be ready when they return.
When the groups came together, there were almost 100 men, and they looked at Nathan expectantly.
Somewhere in this town, there'll be guns and ammunition. All of you need to be armed and ready. We'll start with Ponder's quarters in the jail.
Ponder and Roscoe lay where they had fallen. One of the freed prisoners took the shotgun from Ponder's dead hands, while another seized Roscoe's Colt and pistol belt. They found two more Colts, two Winchesters, and a supply of ammunition, but it was far short of what they needed.
God, there's 50 riders with Sheriff Hondo. If this is all we can find, our shooters will be outgunned near 10-1.
Maybe, but Ponder has dynamite somewhere. He used it building the dam. Let's find that dynamite and we'll even the odds.
They searched the jail and Ponder's quarters without result. In the outer office, a faded, dirty rug covered most of the floor. Shoving Ponder's desk against a wall, Nathan kicked the rug aside, revealing an iron ring flush with the floor. Wooden steps vanished into the darkness.
Anybody down there?
Give me the lamp. Some of you cover me, and I'll go down and light the way.
There was no other way, and Nathan surrendered the lamp.
My God! There's gold down here!
I wouldn't get too excited. It's stolen. What about the dynamite?
One full case and part of another. There's caps and fuses, too.
Some of you get down there and bring up the dynamite. Caps and fuses. We have work to do, and we may not have much time.
After they had brought up the dynamite, Nathan took the lamp and went below. He wanted his own Colts and Winchester, given him by Texas Ranger Captain Sage Jennings. He quickly found the weapons. When he reached the head of the stairs, he found the men had broken out the dynamite.
We'll fuse and cap the single sticks. Short fuses, not more than 6 or 7 seconds. We'll spread out all over town, each of us with a few sticks of dynamite. I found my weapons below, so you can have the pair of Winchesters and Colts I took from Tasby and Doss.
When that bunch rides in, we best throw the dynamite while they're bunched. Elsewise, they'll scatter, and we don't have the guns for a standoff.
That's the idea. If nothing else, the blast should stun them long enough for us to take their guns.
Nathan returned to his picketed horse, taking the Winchesters and extra ammunition from the saddlebags. He'd all but forgotten empty when the dog loped out of the brush. Nathan looked to the south. He knew what it was. There was a faint plume of dust against the blue of the sky. The outlaw posse was returning. Nathan hit the steps to the jail on the run.
Yeah, they're coming. A couple of you stay here with me and the rest of you spread out and take cover. Drop some of that dynamite in their midst. Some will be stunned by the blast, giving you time to grab their guns. The others will come up shooting. It'll be up to those of you with guns to cut them down.
Each man grabbed 2 or 3 sticks of dynamite and they scattered like quail. 2 of the men remained with Nathan. Standing near the door, they could see the first horseman topping the hill to the south. Once the approaching riders were close enough, the defenders wasted no time. Dynamite rained on them. Sheriff Hondo lit out in a run for the jail, only to have a thrown stick of dynamite explode right over his head. When the dust settled, 45 outlaws lay dead. Not one of the defenders had been hurt. The men gathered in front of the jail. They owed their very lives to Nathan Stone, and they listened respectfully as he spoke to them.
Men, what becomes of this town is of no interest to me. I want just one thing. Part of that gold under Ponder's office was stolen from the AT&SF Railroad, and I want it returned. A friend of mine almost gave his life for it.
What happens to the rest of it?
I don't know. If nobody comes along to claim it, I reckon it belongs to those of you who have had part of your lives stolen by Ponder and his outlaws.
Near sundown, 2 riders approached from the north, and some of the men readied their guns.
It's all right. They're friends of mine.
Harley and Vivian Stafford reined up their horses, surprised at the presence of so many armed men.
Get down. It's a long story.
The next morning, Nathan and Harley loaded the gold into the same wagon the thieves had used after stealing the shipment from the railroad. Nathan bid farewell to the men with whom he'd shared captivity and took the trail north with Harley and Vivian. Nathan drove the wagon, his grulla trailing behind on a lead rope, while Harley and Vivian rode alongside. Empty loped well ahead of the wagon.
Railroad owes you for this. I owe you a lot more.
The railroad owes me nothing. I did this for you because you're my friend, not because I see it as a debt to be paid. I'll see you back to Puebla, where all this gold will be the responsibility of the railroad.
Where will you go from there?
I don't know.
Somehow, by the time they reached Pueblo, Nathan knew he had to reach a decision regarding Vivian Stafford. She and Harley had no family, and he believed they should remain together. But he was at a loss as to how he might convince them. He had time to think about it, though. They were more than 500 miles from Pueblo, and even with mules pulling a wagon, they might be on the trail as long as a month. Harley made himself scarce at night, and it became more and more difficult for Nathan not to resume his former intimate relationship with Vivian.
You're avoiding me, Nathan. Why? Are you tired of me?
Yes, I'm avoiding you, but not because I'm tired of you. It's for your sake that I'm backing off. Now I reckon I'll have to tell you why.
Nathan talked for an hour, the two of them sitting on the wagon tongue. And when he'd finished, he had the feeling he hadn't gotten through to her. She quickly confirmed his suspicion.
All right. You've warned me that you're dangerous to be around. I know about your fast gun, your sometimes uncontrollable passion for saloon gambling, and your pride that often kicks common sense out the window. But I still believe in for better or worse. This is the frontier, Nathan. I could get shot by somebody that's gunning for Harley. I'll never complain about where you go or what you do. I'm willing to take my chances with you, and I can't see anything wrong with that. Unless you don't want me.
Vivian, it's got nothing to do with me not wanting you. What I've tried to tell you is that I can't stand the thought of something happening to you as it happened to the others. My conscience can't handle any more.
I think you're blaming yourself unfairly. Perhaps it's a gamble, but you gamble. Why can't I?
Because you're... You...
Because I'm a woman?
No, because we're talking about two different things. Gambling for money is one thing, while gambling your life is another. Trailing with me, you're risking your life, and nothing you can say or do will ever change that. I don't know where, when, or how it'll happen, but it will. It's a feeling that comes over me, and it's never been wrong yet.
Pueblo, Colorado, May 21st, 1877. The railroad showed its gratitude by hosting a dinner at one of the hotels. It became a joint honor for Nathan and Harley, and they were forced to attend. When the affair was over, some of the railroad personnel insisted that Nathan and Harley accompany them to a fancy saloon for drinks. So they went, and Nathan became interested in a high-stakes poker game that was in progress. The winner appeared to be Drew Collins, a little man with thinning dark hair, black eyes, and diamond cufflinks. In a solid black suit, he looked like a preacher or an undertaker, and Nathan developed an instant dislike for him. It was Collins who suggested a $20 limit, and at that point, Harley dropped out.
Too rich for my blood. Maybe we ought to mosey back to the hotel.
Not yet.
Only four men remained, and the pot quickly reached $500. Finally, it reached $1,000, and two more men folded, leaving only Nathan and Collins.
Your turn to fold.
I'll raise you $500.
There was $2,500 in the pot when it was time to show their hands. With a flourish, Collins laid down four face-up aces.
Beat that.
I can.
Nathan dropped five cards on the table. Four of them were kings, and the fifth was an ace of spades. Collins had reached for the pot, and when Nathan seized both his arms, two more aces fell from the sleeves of Collins' coat.
Collins, where I come from, that's called cheating.
Wait, I can explain.
Half a dozen angry men seized Collins, dragged him through the saloon, and flung him out onto the boardwalk.
Mister, you'd best take your money and get out of here. Collins is every bit as touchy as Ben Thompson. He'll kill you.
Come on, Nathan.
Nathan and Harley returned to the hotel. To Nathan's dismay, he found Vivian in his room, and she refused to leave.
Vivian, it's not a good idea for you to be here.
Don't start this again, Nathan.
Harley, tell her.
Oh, no. Tell her yourself. She quit listening to me a long time ago.
Harley decided to remove himself from the middle of an unpleasant moment between his sister and his friend. The next morning, Harley had refused breakfast, and Nathan thought he knew why. Harley didn't intend to involve himself any further in the disagreement. Nathan and Vivian walk down the boardwalk and near to vacant building. One slug burned its way along Nathan's neck under his left ear. With his Colt in his hand, he was off and running. But by the time he reached the old store building, the bushwhacker was gone. Nathan turned back. Vivian Stafford lay on the boardwalk, blood rapidly soaking the left side of her shirt. Nathan had little doubt that Drew Collins had been responsible for the ambush, and in due time he would find the vindictive little gambler, but not until he knew that Vivian was out of danger. He and Harley waited for a verdict from the doctor.
What happened this morning can happen again at any time. Now do you understand what I've been trying to tell Vivian?
I reckon I do.
As soon as I know she's going to live, I aim to ride out. It's up to you to convince her it's for her sake.
You'll be taking care of Collins, then?
Yes, and when I find him, I don't aim for him to have anybody to throw lead at except me.
By the next morning, Vivian was sleeping peacefully, out of danger. Nathan joined Harley Stafford and railroad man Foster Hagerman for breakfast.
First thing I need to know is whether Collins took the train after the shooting. It would be the logical thing unless there was too much time before the next train.
I can answer that. While you and Harley were concerned with Vivian, Sheriff Brody began looking for Collins. The next train east was more than 4 hours away. The sheriff found a livery that had sold Collins a horse and saddle. It's a safe bet that your man is almost to Denver by now.
Thanks. Now, can you take it a step farther? Before I saddle up and light out for Denver, can you wire the Kansas Pacific Terminal and find out whether or not Collins has taken a train east?
Well, it's a 2-day ride from here to Denver. If Collins is headed that way, he won't be there until late this evening. Before you go galloping off anywhere, why don't you talk to Sheriff Brody? He's having the Kansas Pacific Terminal watched by the law in Denver. If Collins shows up there, he'll be arrested. Why don't you wait another day until Brody hears from Denver?
I reckon that makes sense. I just don't like waiting. And if he fails to take the train from Denver, the little varmint's got a 2-day start on me.
He could ride to Cheyenne and take the Union Pacific to California.
My God, that's even worse. Cheyenne's just 100 miles north of Denver. He could reach Denver sometime tonight and be in Cheyenne late tomorrow.
But then you'll never catch up to him on horseback. If Brody gets no response to his inquiry to Denver, have him wire the Union Pacific Terminal in Cheyenne. If Collins doesn't take the train to Denver or Cheyenne, he could have gone anywhere.
It made sense, and Nathan waited. Denver was 150 miles north, while Cheyenne was 100 miles farther. A wild goose chase of such magnitude wasn't very appealing. That evening, Harley and Nathan went to the sheriff's office, but Brody had nothing positive for them.
No sign of Collins at the Kansas Pacific Terminal in Denver.
Will you wire the Union Pacific at Cheyenne?
Yeah. If we don't catch him there, you might as well give up on him taking a train, unless he headed for Hayes when he left here. But I wouldn't consider that likely. It's more than 250 miles.
If he don't show at the Union Pacific Terminal in Cheyenne by tomorrow, we've lost him.
Like hell. He left here on a horse and there's been no rain. That trail I followed into southern Arizona territory was 12 days old. This one will be 3 days old at most.
Following their visit to Sheriff Brody, Nathan and Harley walked to the small hospital where Vivian was recovering.
I've decided. I'm riding with you. It was my sister he shot.
But he was shooting at me. I want you here with Vivian.
Yeah, I reckon I know why. But if you're going to be around until sometime tomorrow, you'll be able to tell her. You owe it to her to tell her yourself.
The two men reached the small hospital where Harley had recovered and where Vivian was now resting.
I've already talked to her this morning. Your turn.
Removing his hat, Nathan went in. Vivian Stafford sat on the edge of the bed.
Well, you surprised me. I expected you to ride out while I was sleeping off the laudanum.
I aim to track down that skunk of a bushwhacker.
I suppose you aim to do it without me.
I do. Do you need more reasons, or is the one you've had enough?
It's enough. When will I see you again?
When I get back to Dodge. Eggerman's checked out every possible railroad connection, including the Union Pacific. I'll have to find the little varmint's trail and ride him down.
Not wasting any more time, Nathan took his horse from the livery, and with empty following, he rode out. When he estimated that he was 5 miles from Pueblo, he began circling the town. With the mostly barren, unsettled Utah territory to the west and a railroad to the east, Nathan expected Collins to ride north or south. When he finally found what he hoped was the trail, it led southeast. Nathan reined up and Empty doubled back.
The way he's headed, Empty, the first town will be Amarillo. That's at least 250 miles, and Fort Worth's twice that. Amarillo's not much more than a wide place in the trail, so we can't hide there. We'll ride the varmint down before he gets to Fort Worth.
Nathan rode on. Near the end of his third day on the trail, he crossed the Cimarron, and there he came upon the camp of some soldiers from Fort Elliott, Texas. There was a lieutenant, a sergeant, and five privates. As Nathan rode in, his hand shoulder high, one of the men, Sergeant Willard, recognized him.
Stone! Come on, and step down! Nathan Stone, this is Lieutenant Bruxton, patrol officer in charge.
Lieutenant?
Mr. Stone? It's late. You're welcome to join us for the night. We'll be returning to Fort Elliott in the morning, and you can ride with us if that's where you're bound. I've heard Captain Selman speak of you. He credits you with helping to establish a twice-weekly stage from Dodge to Fort Griffin.
I reckon it's livened things up a bit.
It has. There's already another saloon, a whorehouse, and a livery at Mobiti.
Last time I saw Captain Selman, he was having problems with just one saloon. I reckon he's not looking forward to a second one.
He ain't. We hear he aims to celebrate by enlarging the post guardhouse.
Nathan shared his bacon with the soldiers, and it wasn't until after supper that he got around to telling them where he was bound and why.
We met your man yesterday just before we crossed the North Canadian. His horse was lame, and he seemed relieved when he learned that there's a livery at Mobiti. There's nothing but a general store to the south beyond the Canadian.
That should slow him down enough for me to catch up to him.
A word of caution. Unless you plan to have him placed under military arrest, I advise you not to confront him on post. The last bunch of civilian hellraisers kicked up such a fuss the noise was heard in Washington.
The Dismukes.
My God, yes, you've heard of them?
I can answer that. After Captain Selman banned that bunch from the post, they snuck back with dynamite with plans to level Fort Elliott. Stone rode back and warned us. Them Dismukes was just plain crazy. We had to shoot them down like dogs. If it hadn't been for Stone, Fort Elliott would have been rubble, and some of us would have been coyote bait.
I don't look for any trouble at the fort. This varmint's the kind to get himself another horse and ride on. The last thing I want is to involve the military in a purely personal matter.
You have no conclusive proof, then?
Nothing that would stand up in court, but enough to satisfy me. He had a motive, and he's running like a scared coyote.
I can understand your position. This is the frontier, and I suspect that for every case taken before a court of law, there are 1,000 settled with fast guns.
His fourth day out of Pueblo, Nathan rode out with the soldiers toward Fort Elliott. Nearing the North Canadian, Lieutenant Bruxton reined up.
This is where his horse lost a shoe.
His problem went beyond a thrown shoe. There's dried blood on that clump of grass.
We should catch up to this gent before he gets to Mobiti.
Maybe not, Sergeant. He'll know I'm gaining on him, and he might have gone on, not stopping for the night.
If that's the case, he'll reach Mobiti ahead of us.
As liveries go, that one in Mobiti ain't nothing to get all excited about. They rent horses to the girls from the whorehouse and the saloons, but I'd be surprised if they got any for sale.
That won't matter to Collins. Coyote that's low down enough to backshoot a man ain't above stealing a horse.
From the sign, he's resting more often. The horse may be weakening, and this gent ain't wanting to tote that saddle.
When at last they could see the distant buildings that made up Mobiti, nothing seemed amiss. But as they drew nearer, Lieutenant Bruxton pointed toward the livery. A roan horse stood with head drooping. A man stepped out of the livery with a bucket in his hand, halting when he saw the riders approaching.
That's Ike Hollister, the livery owner.
Hollister set the bucket down before the spent roan and turned to face the riders.
Well, Ike, I see you've been horse trading.
Horse trading hell! I gets up this morning and finds this poor critter just a-standing here near dead. Next thing I knows, some skunk's behind me with a pistol in my back. He near knocked my brains out, and when I wakes up, he's done took my bay. Best damn hoss I ever had.
What can you tell us about the thief?
Nothing. Damn it, I told you he come up behind me. I never laid eyes on the skunk. Since we ain't got law here, what do you aim to do about it?
Speaking on behalf of the army, there's not much we can do, but here's a man who might be able to help you. This is Nathan Stone.
Ike eyed Nathan skeptically, and Nathan quickly repeated his reason for following Drew Collins.
Well, I hope you gut shoot the varmint, but that won't help me none after he's rode my horse to death.
I'll catch up to him before he's had time for that. And I'll return your horse. How far ahead of me is he?
Maybe 2 hours.
Lieutenant, I'll need a fresh horse. I'll leave my horse here and clear it with Captain Selman.
You don't have any time to spare. Come on to the post and I'll see that you get a horse. I don't believe Captain Selman will object to that.
Nathan mounted and rode out, empty loping along behind. Since he had no idea what might be the fugitive's destination, Nathan prepared to ride in a circle until he eventually found the trail. To his surprise, he found the trail immediately. It headed due north.
Well, by God, unless he changes course, he's headed for Dodge, and since it's less than 60 miles, he'll get there ahead of me. If Mr. Wyatt Earp is still town marshal, this ought to be interesting.
2 days after Nathan rode out of Pueblo, the doctor pronounced Vivian Stafford able to travel. The next morning, she and Harley went to the station to board the eastbound to return to Dodge. Before departing, they went to the railroad office to talk to Foster Hagerman. While there, Harley looked out Hagerman's office window just in time to see Drew Collins riding toward the depot.
My God. Yonder comes that damn back-shooting gambler, Drew Collins.
That can't be. It makes no sense.
Sense or not, he's here. I don't know how he escaped Nathan, but he won't escape me. Damn him, he's going to die. Collins! You're covered! Get down off of that horse!
Ignoring the challenge, Collins kicked the horse into a gallop. Mounting his own horse on the run, Harley galloped in pursuit. But fate took a hand on behalf of Drew Collins. Marshal Wyatt Earp stepped out into the street, a Colt in his hand, forcing Harley to rein up.
Damn it, he's a killer! He shot my sister from ambush in Pueblo!
Can you prove that?
No, but he did it!
Not good enough. Put the gun away or I'll jail you for disturbing the peace.
Furious, Harley holstered his Colt and rode on in the direction Collins had gone. But Earp followed, and they caught up to Collins as he was about to enter Delmonico's. Collins waited, and Harley couldn't believe the nerve of the man.
Mister, the gent on the horse claims you shot his sister in Pueblo. What do you have to say for yourself?
I just rode in from Texas, Marshal. I've never been in Pueblo in my life, and I've never seen this man before until he took to throwing lead at me.
Mm-hmm.
Earp glared at Harley, and it became clear that Harley had just ridden up a stump in his pursuit of justice at the hands of the law. Without a word, he returned to the railroad depot, where he found Hagerman waiting for him.
That bastard Earp, taking that little coyote's word over mine. He threatened to jail me for disturbing the peace.
I'll admit he seems kind of slow-witted at times, but for the sake of the railroad, we have to get along with him.
Maybe you do, but I don't. I'm no longer with the railroad. I quit as of right now.
Oh, damn it, you don't have to quit. Collins can't hide behind Earp forever. When he moves on, you follow. Earp's jurisdiction doesn't go beyond Dodge.
When I follow, I'll have Nathan Stone with me. Unless Collins set up another ambush and pulled it off, Nathan will be here.
A little more than 2 hours later, Nathan reined up before the depot and stepped into Hagerman's office.
Collins is here. Harley went after him and Earp got in the way.
Where's Harley now?
Stalking Collins. For the sake of the railroad, I warned him against antagonizing Earp, and he threatened to quit the railroad.
I don't blame him. He's dodged that hard up for a lawman?
Well, I didn't accept Harley's resignation. He has my permission to follow Collins when he rides out beyond Earp's jurisdiction.
He won't be riding now. He'll hunker right here and wait for the next eastbound.
Now, where are you going?
Fortunately, I don't work for the railroad.
I can't stand behind you if you go against the law.
I don't recall asking you to.
Nathan found Harley leaning against a hitch rail across the dirt street from the Long Branch Saloon.
He's in there, I reckon.
Yeah, and so is Earp. He's had a mad on for me ever since I came here. With Hagerman's help, he's using this Collins coyote to put me down.
I don't work for Hagerman, and since Collins was shooting at me, this is my fight. I came here for Collins, and I'll get him. if I have to take Earp's pistol away from him and bend it over his skull. Come on.
With Harley following, Nathan crossed the street to the Long Branch. Wyatt Earp leaned against the bar. Drew Collins sat at a table with three other men involved in a poker game. Ignoring Earp, Nathan stalked to the table where Collins sat facing the door. Collins rose to his feet, his hands shoulder high.
You got nothing against me, Stone, and I ain't armed.
You back-shooting son of a—
Back off, Stone!
I'll kill you with my bare hands!
Nathan seized Drew Collins by his shirt front, dragging him across the table. Earp went for his gun.
Stone! One more move out of you and I'll shoot you. Now you turn around and do it slow. Then you loosen your pistol belts and let them fall.
Nathan released Collins and turned around slowly, standing between Earp and Collins.
Nathan!
Nathan dropped to the floor and rolled, coming up on one knee. Collins had drawn a gun from beneath his coat. Nathan's cold answered him. Nathan got to his feet, holstered his Colt, and fixed his cold eyes on Earp.
Mr. Earp, that little sidewinder was about to finish what he started in Pueblo, when he ambushed me and gunned down Vivian Stafford. If it hadn't been for Harley, he'd have shot me in the back with you allowing it to happen. I'm claiming self-defense.
I'm calling it self-defense. This time. You're not welcome here, and I want you out of town.
I have friends here, and I'll go when I'm ready. I'm not ready.
Nathan and Harley left the Long Branch, mounted their horses, and rode back toward the railroad depot.
That was smooth. You showed Collins up for the back-shooting coyote he was. Even Earp could see that.
But he didn't like seeing it at his expense, and he'll be watching me. I could end up in his juzgado for spitting on the boardwalk.
Vivian's going to be glad to see you. She won't hardly leave the Dodge House unless I'm with her. She can't stand Earp, and he follows her like a shadow. Since I'm with the railroad, I can't antagonize Earp without Hagerman coming down on me. Might as well warn you. She's decided she'd rather risk being shot with you than have Earp follow her around when I ain't here. I've talked to Hagerman, but he claims he's in no position to discipline Earp. Hagerman's just one of 10 men on the town council, and the rest of them are sold on Earp. I'm thinking of quitting the railroad, taking Vivian, and moving on.
For the times, it's a good job. Nothing else pays as well. If you quit, where will you go and what will you do?
I have no idea. I've been doing it for Vivian. I ran out on her once and I won't do it again.
I understand and I agree with you. Something must be done. We're stuck with Earp until he moves on or the town council gets enough of him, and I don't see you quitting the railroad as a solution. If you're willing to risk it and she wants to go, I'll take Vivian with me.
She wants to go and I'm willing for her to. We just don't want you feeling like you've been boxed in, that she's become a burden.
She's never been a burden. If I didn't care for her, I wouldn't be concerned about something happening to her.
Like what happened in Pueblo. We understand and appreciate your concern, but she's willing to take the risk. I'm willing because she needs a man like you. I know you would fight to the death for her, and no man who ever lived could do more than that. Take her. My blessing. She's at the Dodge House. Why don't you ride over there and tell her what you've decided?
I will. Tomorrow I'll be riding back to Fort Elliott. I left my Gruya there, and I promised to return the horse Collins stole from the livery at Mo Beattie.
Vivian was cautious when she heard the knock.
Who is it?
Nathan.
Oh, I'm so glad to see you. Come in and tell me what's happened.
She closed and locked the door, and Nathan told her everything, up to and including the showdown with Drew Collins.
Wyatt Earp may be a wonderful town marshal, but I can't stand him. Now he'll make it as hard on you as he can because you've made him look small.
Well, he doesn't cast as long a shadow as he thinks. Vivian, Harley and me just had a talk, and we've decided you're better off with me being shot at than being stalked by Senor Earp while Harley's away.
Do you mean it? Do you really want me?
I mean it, and I do want you. I just don't want you shot, but neither do I want Earp hounding you. I'll buy you a horse, a saddle, and saddlebags. We'll leave for Fort Elliott and Mo Beattie in the morning.
I'll be ready. Will you be joining Harley and me for supper?
Yes, and for now, you'd best stay where you are. Earp's out there in the lobby.
St. Louis, Missouri, May 27th, 1877. Young John Wesley Tremaine would soon be 11 years old. John Tremaine, his grandfather, had been dead a year, leaving his widow Anna to raise the boy as best she could, with no real information to give him about how he came to be.
Grandma?
Yes, dear?
Why can't you tell me something about my pa?
There's nothing for me to tell, John.
Who was he?
John, I can't tell you what I don't know.
Don't call me John, Grandma. Call me Wes, like Wes Harden the Outlaw.
I will not. You were named after your grandfather, John, and my own father, Wesley.
Well, I'll bet people called your father Wes.
Don't you sass me. Now go tend to your chores. Supper will be in a little while.
Ah.
As the boy stomped toward his chores, Anna Tremaine removed her spectacles and rubbed her eyes.
Oh, John.
She sat and looked out the window at her grandson. Now that her husband was gone and her own health was failing, what was going to become of the boy? He had been given his grandfather's watch. Inside the cover was the only photograph they had of Molly Tremaine, John Wesley's mother. She had died at the boy's birth, and all they knew of the affair that had led to the child's arrival was the little she had written in her diary. Anna and John Tremaine had been away from home when it happened, leaving Molly by herself. The departure and return dates were recorded in the diary, and nothing else except a man's name, Nathan. They hadn't known the diary existed until Molly was dead. She had told them nothing. The final entry, written the day before Molly died, had been a message directed to John and Anna Tremaine, her parents.
I'm truly sorry. Sorry for what I've done. And sorry to burden you so. The child is to be told nothing.
Approaching her time of delivery, Molly Tremaine had been deathly ill, screaming as she awakened from her sleep and troubled with premonitions of her own death. John and Anna had fulfilled her wishes, telling the boy not even the little they knew or suspected. Now more than ever, Anna Tremaine regretted having lived a lie, for she feared the bitterness she could see in the cold blue eyes of young John Wesley Tremaine. Fort Elliott, Texas, May 28, 1877.
While we're here at Fort Elliott, I want you to buy me a pistol and a supply of shells. If I'm going to be shot at, I intend to shoot back.
You should have told me before we left Dodge. The 31 caliber Colt pocket pistols are might easier to handle, but the sutler's store may not have them.
Nathan had returned the stolen horse to the livery in Mobeetee, and the horse that Lieutenant Bruxton had loaned him to the quartermaster's corral. Vivian led her horse as they walked back to the orderly room at the post commander's office. Sergeant Willard grinned at them as they entered the orderly room.
Captain Selman's expecting you.
Nathan opened the door to Selman's office, and he and Vivian stepped inside. Except for more gray in his hair, Selman had changed little.
Lieutenant Bruxton told me you had stopped long enough to borrow a fresh horse and had gone on your way. I trust your mission was successful?
It was. I've returned your horse along with the one stolen from the livery in Mobeetee. Do I owe anything for the loan of the horse?
We'll call it even, since you recovered the horse taken from Ike's livery. With the army being the only law in these parts, he'd have never let us forget we had fallen down on the job. Will you folks be staying the night?
If you can put us up. My dog didn't make it any farther than the mess hall.
The cooks haven't forgotten him. They never have anything to throw out while he's here.
I've been away from the newspapers and the telegraph for a while. Is there anything of importance happening?
Congress finally got together long enough to agree on one sensible bill. Reconstruction is over, and the people are again in control of their local governments.
Thank God. It's been hard times.
Well, it's been hard on the military, too. We've had to enforce an unpopular law that most of us thought harsh and vindictive. I doubt we'll ever live it down.
I think you will, Captain. Most folks are coming to realize that many of their problems originate in Congress. I came west right after the war, and I've always been treated fairly by the military.
Well, it's kind of you to adopt that attitude. But it seems we no sooner put out one fire than Congress starts another. According to the Telegraph, there are small ranchers in Wyoming calling for soldiers to prevent a range war.
Why, hell, Wyoming's still a territory.
Well, of course it is. But there are petitions for statehood cropping up all over the frontier. And it's only a matter of time until those territories become part of the Union. Supposedly, that's why the Congress passed the Desert Land Act back in March.
It's already causing trouble?
In spades. The act provides for the sale of 160 acres of land at 25 cents an acre to anyone willing to irrigate a portion of the land within 3 years, and at the end of that time, to pay an additional dollar an acre to secure ownership.
That sounds reasonable enough, but I reckon it ain't working out that way.
No. While the bill was passed supposedly to help pioneers, it's doing exactly the opposite. Apparently, it was lobbied through Congress by a few wealthy cattlemen as a means of acquiring enormous tracts of land for next to nothing. As the small ranchers have pointed out, a man with money can gobble up thousands of acres. He needs to hire just 4 men and get their signatures on the proper papers, and he has control of a full section, 640 acres.
And that's what's happening in Wyoming.
In the Powder River Basin. Some of them have picked up blanket Indians, had them sign the necessary papers, and claimed land in their names. With Congress on the outs with President Hayes, there'll be no soldiers deployed, but there'll be trouble in Wyoming for somebody. The Powder River may run red.
On that somber note, Nathan and Vivian left Selman's office. Sergeant Willard then led them to a cabin that had been assigned to them for the night.
Supper's at 5. I'll see you then.
You get along well with the military.
They've been more than decent to me. And on the frontier, a man needs all the friends he can get. Besides, they've had the telegraph, and I've often needed it. I never know when I'll have need of it again. Remember how it got word to us when Harley had been shot?
I'll never forget that. Where are we going when we leave here?
First to Fort Worth. I'd like to leave word with Captain Ferguson where I can be reached. Then we'll go on to New Orleans. When I'm tired of drifting, of shooting, and being shot at, I spend a few weeks or months with my friends Barnabas and Bess McQueen. They have a horse ranch, and Yulee's buried next to the horse barn.
They'll always remember you being there with her. Do you think I'll be welcome?
Of course you will. That's where I told Harley he could reach us if he needs to.
It sounds nice. What will we do there?
As little as possible. We'll eat, sleep, and maybe attend a horse race or two. Barnabas trains horses and races them.
New Orleans, June 9th, 1877.
We won't spend any time in town. I'm fair to Midland sure there's at least a few hombres here that would like to see me dead.
Nathan and Vivian rode on until they could see the roof of McQueen's horse barn. Empty ran on ahead and without hesitation took the tree-lined road toward the distant McQueen house.
It all looks so peaceful.
But looks were deceiving.
Something's wrong.
Vivian followed, reining up behind Nathan as they neared the house. It had a vacant look, and the front door stood open. Empty awaited their arrival. Nathan's heart sank. Near the house lay the mutilated remains of Barnabas McQueen's 4 hounds. As unnerving as the sight was, the odor was worse. Nathan went closer. Quickly, he turned away and returned to the Gruya.
What killed them?
They were shot. We'll leave the horses next to the barn and go on to the house on foot. Keep your pistol handy. I don't know what's waiting for us.
Remembering the McQueens had always entered the house through the kitchen, Nathan ignored the open front door. Vivian followed him around the house, waiting as he tried the back door. It opened readily, and she followed him into the kitchen. A chair lay on its side, and fragments of a broken dish were scattered on the floor. A length of stove wood lay under the table, while on the otherwise clean white tablecloth, there were flecks of dried blood.
They put up a fight, but they were taken away. The dogs had been dead maybe 2 days.
What could have happened to them, and why?
I don't know, but I have an idea. Barnabas bought and trained horses. Expensive horses. Let's have a look in the barn.
There were no horses in the barn. Vivian stepped out ahead of Nathan, and he closed the door. Immediately, he began looking for tracks, and there were plenty.
The trail's 2 days old. What I don't understand is why they didn't kill Barnabas and Bess instead of taking them along.
Empty's found something.
The dog ran toward them. He ran back the way he'd come.
Well, it's right. He's found a trail.
They rode as fast as the trail would let them, Empty keeping well ahead of them, and when they reached a patch of bare ground, Nathan reined up, studying the tracks.
10 horses. 4 of them on lead ropes. Allowing mounts for Barnabas and Bess, there's 4 of the varmints.
The trail led to the south. Occasionally, the distant blue of the Gulf of Mexico could be seen through the trees.
This makes no sense. The way they're headed, there'll soon be water everywhere except behind them. That leaves just one possibility.
A boat!
Yes, and that's where we'll lose them.
But the trail began veering back to the west, following the shoreline, and the blue of the gulf was clearly visible to their left. Entering a profusion of undergrowth, willows, and cane, they were forced to dismount and lead their horses. Suddenly before them was the desolate remains of a cabin. The shake roof was gone. The standing walls were so mossed over they were all but invisible.
We'll have to take it slow. They could be holed up there. Empty says it's safe. Come on.
They found Barnabas McQueen first. He lay face down, his hands bound behind him, and he'd been shot twice in the back.
Vivian, see if you can find Bess.
Cutting the bonds, Nathan tried both wrists but failed to find a pulse. Frantically, he sought the big artery in the neck and found a spark of life.
I found Bess.
How bad?
Bad enough. She's been stripped, brutalized, and shot, but she's still alive. She's burning up with fever.
Oh, so is Barnabas, but at least they're alive. We've got to get them to a doctor, pronto, and we'll need a buckboard. We're only 3 or 4 miles south of town. I'll leave Empty with you, and I'll be back as soon as I can.
Waiting for Nathan, Vivian looked around for Bess McQueen's clothing. Finding none, she wrapped the unfortunate woman in a blanket. She then went to see about Barnabas and was startled to find his eyes open, watching her.
Who are you?
Vivian Stafford. I'm with Nathan Stone. He's gone for a buckboard.
Bess, what about...
She's alive.
Thank God.
It seemed hours before Nathan arrived with a buckboard. They quickly loaded the pair into the wagon. Nathan climbed to the seat, flicked the reins, and started the team toward town. Vivian rode alongside while Empty followed. Nathan turned on to St. Charles. As they neared the LaCroix Hospital, Vivian spurred ahead to make them aware of two patients badly in need of attention. Nathan soon reined up before the hospital. By the time he was off the box, attendants were there with stretchers. Empty remained with the buckboard while Nathan and Vivian followed the stretcher-bearing attendants into the hospital. A nurse approached Nathan with pad and pencil.
Barnabas and Bess McQueen, they've been shot.
Who are you? Are you responsible for them?
A friend of theirs, Nathan Stone, and yes, I'll be responsible for them. Do what you must. They're burning up with fever.
Barnabas and Bess were taken away, and it was almost an hour before Nathan and Vivian had any word. Finally, a doctor approached them.
I'm Dr. McHenry. I've removed the lead, and fortunately their vitals have been spared, but they've lost a lot of blood, and infection has already taken hold. We're doing our best to save them. Have you notified the police?
No. We have no idea who shot them. There'll be time enough for that when they're able to talk. When will you have another report on their condition?
Oh, you should know something by noon tomorrow.
They found a boarding house with a stable across the alley, not far from the LaCroix Hospital. Their room was in the rear, with an outside entrance.
Might as well get some rest. I don't know of anything to do in this town except visit the saloons, drink, and gamble.
I think we can do better than that. Besides, if you've had trouble here, you shouldn't be seen any more than necessary.
My thoughts exactly. I don't know that I still have enemies here, but I don't want to confirm it by being shot in the back.
Rather than attract too much attention, Nathan and Vivian left their horses stabled and walked back to the LaCroix Hospital. They waited half an hour before the doctor could see them.
Another day and the infection would have been too far advanced. But you got them here in time, and unless they take an unexpected turn for the worse, I believe they'll recover.
How long before we can talk to them?
Not for another 48 hours. And maybe, not then, it will depend on their progress.
McHenry ended the conversation and went about his business, leaving Nathan and Vivian with time on their hands. For the lack of anything better to do, they returned to their room at the boarding house.
Now, aren't you glad I came with you?
I am, for a fact. I've never been very good at waiting around with nothing to do. Can you keep me busy until supper time?
I reckon, but not with you standing there on your boots, breeches, hat, and gun belt.
Among other things, they slept, awakening an hour before sundown.
Well, I know a cafe near the Pioneer Hotel that serves fried catfish. I'm willing to risk getting shot for a mess of catfish.
Is that all they have?
Oh, no. They have gator tail, crab, oysters, and just about any kind of critter that can be hauled out of the river or the gulf.
I've always been partial to catfish myself.